This week on The Special Ed Strategist.
And I realized by reading the definition of trauma-informed care, I was already doing it, but there were ways that I could do it bigger, better, and that our community, our staff, we could be trauma-informed to the students and trauma-informed to ourselves. At this location, the staff and the residents are not allowed to use violent language because we know the histories of the people that are working there. So by eliminating those phrases, we are reducing the risk of just sending someone into a panic. When survival brain takes over, their brain is just saying, safety, 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 I need to be safe. And you coming in saying everything's fine, well, that goes into trust and transparency. It's not our job as educators to decide what's trauma and what isn't. So for example, the word divorce. If you have a child whose parents are going through divorce, you start automatically putting together your life experiences, whether it's a friend of yours, your parents, whoever it was, and you start assessing, well, that's not trauma. It's an individual's perspective of an experience.
Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Hello, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. Today, we're going to be talking to Rachel, a speech-language pathologist and trauma-informed care advocate who has dedicated her work to helping educators and professionals implement that trauma-informed practices throughout their classroom, their school, and their day. So welcome to the show, Rachel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I bet. And this is incredible depth of information that we should talk about as educators, as professionals, helping students kind of navigate their world. And before we jump in, I do like to ask the question. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, but I also want to know, what is one thing about you that people don't know doesn't necessarily align with what you do for your job?
Okay.
Put those in either order.
Okay. One thing that people don't know about me, I work at a Pilates studio. So I'm a full-time speech pathologist. I do presentations around the country and 3 to 4 days a week, I work at a Pilates studio. So that is another speaking thing that I do. I'm also an ordained minister. I've officiated 2 weddings. So that's, I just keep doing these speaking opportunities, but those are some unknown things about me, I guess. And my name is Rachel Archambeau. I'm a speech pathologist. I'm a speech program specialist in Broward County, Florida. It's the 6th largest district in the country. So I support 44 high schools and 102 SLPs right now.
I love those little tips of little things we didn't know about you and the work that you're doing. Can you just start us off and give us a little bit of background of how you became focused and really wanting to do more with trauma-informed care?
Absolutely. So in undergrad and grad school, I realized, I guess in my career, that we didn't really have a focus on counseling, yet I was always drawn to the more counseling parts of my job. So stuttering was always something I really enjoyed. And the way that stuttering therapy kind of works, it's more of a counseling aspect. It's what emotions are you feeling right now? Where's the tightness present in your body? And I didn't realize why I really enjoyed that aspect. I always was kind of interested in being a psychologist or mental health counselor. I really loved that counseling aspect. In 2018, I worked at a school called Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, and I experienced a traumatic event at work. It was my 2nd year as a speech pathologist, my 1st year completely on my own. My 1st year, I was a clinical fellow, which is the first 9 months it's more supervised. And this was the 1st year on my own. So experiencing this traumatic event in a community, in a national lens, was very difficult. And I had a really difficult time coming back to school, trying to figure out why we should focus on an R sound or a reading disability or whatever it is when we didn't feel safe. Our safety was broken. Our trust was broken. So that was what led me to search for a solution. And I went on Google and I said, how do you help a community that's been traumatized? And something I kept seeing was trauma-informed care. And I realized by reading the definition of trauma-informed care, I was already doing it, but there were ways that I could do it bigger, better, and that our community, our staff, we could be trauma-informed to the students and trauma-informed to ourselves. Our administrators could be trauma-informed to us to reduce causing harm to us. That's the goal of trauma-informed care, is reducing harm. And with a community that has been harmed so heavily, you want to reduce our risk of causing that harm.
I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time just... It's just your story is so emotional.
No, please. I appreciate. I mean, for me, it's been, that was 2018. It was Valentine's Day, 2018. So I'm very far removed from it from this point. You know, it was highly emotional at that point, but there's, your brain has to compartmentalize. And now I can talk about it without getting emotional, but I really appreciate when people do get emotional around it because I put it in a box sometimes, you know, I forget about it. I purposefully forget about it. But when other people are emotional, it makes me feel like people still care about it. People still remember it and that it's important to, and not to just put it in a box.
Yeah. And you speak today with such confidence and grace that I know what you're going to share for the rest of this podcast is really going to help guide and direct others. I also knew your background. And so I knew it'd be hard, but so excuse me and thank you and all of those things. So what exactly then is trauma-informed care and why should every professional in education really understand it and start to act upon it?
So I like to say that trauma-informed care is a mindset shift, not a prescriptive technique. A lot of people, when they hear about trauma-informed care, they start going, all right, what are the steps to doing that? And that's not really what it is. It's a mindset shift. Some of you who are listening might be familiar with the book, What Happened to You by Oprah and Dr. Bruce Perry. If you're not familiar with it, I would say that that is a great introductory book. Some of the other books that are out there, such as The Body Keeps a Score, is very heavy. And a lot of people tell me that they don't really finish it because they're not ready for that. So I always recommend What Happened to You by Oprah and Dr. Bruce Perry as an intro level. And also the audiobook is fantastic. It's a great conversational piece between Dr. Bruce Perry, who is the world's leading child trauma expert, and Oprah, who has made a career interviewing people about their trauma and talking about her own trauma, right? But what is trauma-informed care is there's a bunch of definitions out there, but there's 3 to 4 R's. Realizing the prevalence of trauma, recognizing how trauma affects all individuals involved with the program, organization, system, including its own workforce, which would be us, the SLPs, the teachers, the educators, responding by putting this knowledge into practice. And the 4th R is resisting re-traumatization. So I always say that the goal of trauma-informed care is reducing the risk of us causing harm to our clients, our students, the families that we support, potentially other coworkers, and what administrators can do to be trauma-informed to us as well.
When you think about your situation, it was on a broader scale. And as you said, like through a national lens, how do educators and professionals think about it, big picture, little picture, because it may just be it may be a student within our classroom that shows up every day with trauma versus a more broader community?
Yes. Okay. Great question. So I like to say that leading up to what happened at our school, we should have been trained, we, the staff, in trauma-informed care. I believe that trauma-informed care is preventative. It's for when you don't know what trauma your students have experienced. If you just go around assuming that most of your students have undergone trauma, then you can change your words, you can adjust your language, you can do these little things to ensure that you don't cause harm. After what happened at our school, we should have been provided with trauma-specific or trauma-sensitive services. So that's a different level. Our entire community, we know at least one trauma they possibly have gone through. However, we had 3,600 students at the school. We had probably 300 staff members. There are some people potentially who don't believe that they've gone through a traumatic event. Their bodies don't feel that it's been a traumatic event. So you can have 2 people experience the same thing and say, yes, it's trauma for them, and no, it's not. But if we assume that it potentially is a traumatic event, then we can adjust certain things. So an example would be after what happened at our school, they stopped ringing the fire alarms for fire drills. They just came on the intercom system to say, hey, everyone, in about 5 minutes, we're going to be going through this fire drill. It's necessary for us to do once a month. That way, the sound we knew was a trigger for many students and staff. We were able to change that based on what we know about that population. I believe that at all schools that could be done. Why don't we just do that? Because we know that those sounds are very difficult to many of our ESE students, our neurodiverse children, the staff. I know I'm very sensitive to noise already. So if they just came on the intercom and said, hey, we're about to go on a fire drill right now, the outcome that we want is still that people will evacuate their rooms, right? If in case of an emergency that the fire alarm happens, then we know that it's a true emergency. So there are certain things that we can do, changing our language, changing our response to things. But for the most part, you are not going to know what traumas your students have gone through. And it's not our job to start investigating. Let's sit them down and take out a pen and pencil and start recording what traumas they've gone through. No, we're not going to know that. But we can do certain things to make sure that we are reducing our chance at causing harm to someone.
What does that look like in behavioral terms, right? So if we're not going to investigate, obviously there's a lot of reasons for that, of individual traumas within a student and then within the population that we support. But how does that look for an educator with behavior and learning?
So one thing that I acknowledge with behavior is that what is this behavior showing me? So something that I recommend in my presentations is if a student comes in who I know very well, let's say I've been working with them for 6 months, and then all of a sudden I see a behavior change, I'm not going to walk up to them and say, what trauma have you exhibited lately? Like that's not the plan of that. But I will start making a mental note of, Rachel's acting a little bit strange today. Like, let me keep an eye on that. Let me see how this week goes. If you've built a relationship, say like, hey, I've noticed you've been a little sad this week, or you've been really tired, or your grades have fallen this week. Like, I'd be happy to support you. Is everything going okay? Not what trauma have you exhibited, you know? But these are things that teachers can absolutely do, is just start that mental tally of like, that behavior is unusual. Then we can refer to the appropriate person, which would be the mental health counselor at school, the guidance counselor, the school psychologist, whoever it is. If something comes out that said, hey, yeah, I got in a car accident a couple weeks ago and I just can't stop thinking about it, then you can help refer to the right person. Other behaviors, something that I like to teach about is, I'm a person who's been diagnosed with PTSD and ADHD. So my train of thought goes very, very quickly. The symptoms of ADHD and PTSD are almost exact. So when you're looking at a kid, and these veteran teachers have been there for 40 years, they say, I know an ADHD kid like the back of my hand. That is one. I take a step back and I say, what is this behavior? Like, how can I support this behavior, rather than saying that's ADHD? And we just say it's a choice of theirs, it's a behavior of theirs. How can I help support this behavior that they are exhibiting, and maybe acknowledge that not everything is ADHD or not everything is PTSD? Just, what is that behavior? What is the purpose of that behavior?
And side note, What Happened to You is an excellent book.
Yes, it is.
I did do the audio version and I was shaking my head, and it also is that framing, which I coming back to what I'm going to ask is, I love that getting curious and kind of thinking through and what are my next steps to support a student. Can we just talk about the R's for a second and
yes,
kind of break that down a little bit more? So like, what does realizing look like? Recognizing, responding, what does that look like? And how would we kind of implement?
Okay. So number one, being realizing the prevalence of trauma, that's really just, how much does it exist in our life? I think the statistic that I usually use is, 2/3 of children before the age of 16 have experienced at least one traumatic event. So for me, working in high schools mainly, I can assume that most of my students, or 60% of my students, have experienced a traumatic event, rather than people going around saying, well, this population of kids don't have trauma, or this population of kids absolutely does. Like, it's somewhere in the middle there. We can't say based on a certain background. We can say based on certain factors, this might contribute to trauma. So realizing the prevalence is just acknowledging that it exists much more than we might assume in our world. In the 1990s, there was a study done called the ACEs study, which I also typically get away from. It's the adverse childhood experiences. The limitations of that study is that there were only 10 potentially traumatic events on that list, or adverse childhood experiences on that list. What about the rest of the things in the world that happen, right? So the benefit of that study is, what came out is, the more traumatic events in childhood, the worse physical health outcomes, physical, emotional outcomes. up to a 20% or a 20-year reduction in life expectancy. Wow. That's huge. So yeah. I hear this a lot in the parenting community and the education community. Children are so resilient. And I really don't like that phrase because it basically says it'll just bounce off them, no effects from it. And there is some benefit to it. However, we have this study that shows the more traumatic events in childhood, the worse physical health outcomes. So whether we acknowledge that it's traumatic or not, our logical brain, our brain and our body are telling us it is trauma. Like, this is how it's affecting us. So realizing the prevalence of trauma, it exists and it is a national health crisis. We are experiencing trauma at high levels and it is going to cause physical health outcomes in the future for the acute care system, having to support everyone that has these adverse childhood experiences, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all of those contribute or are correlated to traumatic events in childhood. That's a lot.
That's a lot. That's a lot. I mean, right, yes. There is just unpacking a lot, right? In terms yes. of where to go with that information and what to do. And so I think that's a huge step forward for us as parents and educators and caregivers and support folks as well. You know, all our research, the SLPs and OTs and PTs, and just recognizing and realizing the prevalence of it. And then, well, that was the realize. So then we're going to recognize it. So what's
recognize.
What would the difference be then?
So recognizing how trauma affects all individuals involved with the program, organization, system, including the workforce. So in education, I am the one supporting the student, right? I cannot be 100% trauma informed if the systems in place above me are not trauma informed. So let's say for teachers, if you have 60 kids in your classroom for some reason, if the classroom size caps aren't being held to, you are not going to be able to be as trauma informed as you would like to. Also, the trauma that happens in the school system to the teachers. One of the things to acknowledge is high stress environments can cause trauma. So the amount of stress that teachers are under contribute to the possibility of us causing harm to our students. So if our workplace was a trauma-informed workplace, our administrators would be trauma-informed to us. And we'll be talking about what trauma-informed actually means with the 6 pillars of trauma-informed care. How can our administrators be more trauma-informed to us? And it's the same as how can we be more trauma-informed to our students? But recognizing how trauma-informed care and trauma not only affect the bottom rung, but all levels above that.
And I think in this, where we are currently in education, it's a high-stress environment.
Yes, it is.
Without a doubt, we have, you know, I'm just even through the special education lens, shortages, not enough hours are going in, data collection, the whole thing. There's just so many things that are piled, different curriculums, new curriculums, you know, different kiddos in your class. And I think that right there's a high stress environment. So if we realize it and we recognize it, what can we do about it?
There's a couple things that we can do. Changing our language is my favorite thing to talk about. So with what you all know about my school situation, a phrase that I didn't know was violent language. So that was actually given to me in one of my presentations, that someone in the audience said that their child works at a domestic violence clinic. And at this location, the staff and the residents are not allowed to use violent language because we know the histories of the people that are working there. So by eliminating those phrases, we are reducing the risk of just sending someone into a panic or taking them out of their learning brain. So an example of violent language, something that I hear all day, every day, is shoot me a text, shoot me an email. There's a lot of like gun-related things that we say or killing related things that we use. And I promise after this recording, everyone in the audience is going to start thinking about, oh, that's a violent phrase. And that's a violent phrase. Like, you don't realize it. So for teachers, if you're working with, let's say 15 kindergartners or 30 kindergartners, depending on how big your classroom is, right? You would assume that they are not experiencing domestic violence or have experienced gun violence at home, anything like that. But if we say, what if they have, and we remove violent language for everyone rather than the one student that we know it has happened, we are reducing our risk of causing harm to the whole population. We don't know the histories of the rest of them. We might know the history of one of them. So I like to remove violent language altogether. One thing that I stop saying is when something is funny, I stop saying, I'm dying, because hearing that after trauma with many people dying, I got sick, you know, of just like that. I can't use that anymore. It's not appropriate. And I don't know what people have gone through in front of me. I do get people in my audience who are saying, oh, well, you can't say anything anymore. You know, everyone's so offended. And I understand why people say that. However, our job in education and in healthcare, we are trying to teach someone something. We are trying to teach children something. And we want to keep children in their learning brain. There's a difference between the learning brain and the survival brain. If the survival brain is on, they cannot learn. So if I'm saying something that distracts them, they're thinking about something, they are not in their learning brain and they are not going to meet the goals that we've set. So I always try to reduce the chance of sending them into their survival brain, making them feel as safe as possible. And that's done through the 6 pillars of trauma-informed care. But it's just a mindset shift. Again, let me remove violent language. Let me remove certain things that I say to try to make sure that I don't cause harm.
And this we're talking about respond, right?
Yes.
And I think it's fascinating that you brought that up because it reminds me, so my middle son is a brain cancer survivor. He had to do brain surgery. And I've mentioned that on this podcast. But one thing that I haven't mentioned and was said to us is, so he was 5 before surgery. And they said, just don't tell him. We're going to put him to sleep because that's what you tell when you have an animal. You're going to put him to sleep and then the animal doesn't come home. And so It was a moment of like, oh, okay, that's right. You know, and so that education piece is crucial.
I use that very example all the time, just different language changes. And I'm not sure if in your situation, you worked with a child life specialist in a child. So that is the coolest profession. And if I were to go to school now today, I would be a child life specialist. Little things that are said based on a 30-year research of what causes trauma to this population, childhood cancer survivors, little things that are said that we can reduce our chance of making an already traumatic experience less traumatic. That's an awesome example. So just little things that we can say, oh, wow, I didn't think of it that way. We do use that example for when an animal dies, let's not equate that to us dying because that will scare them, right? So great example. Awesome.
Now, what is our last R?
Resisting re-traumatization, which basically is everything that we have talked about today, or just, I try to put that at the forefront of my mind. How can I reduce causing harm? How can I reduce causing re-traumatization to this population? So that kind of encompasses all of them, but that should be our main goal as educators, to reduce causing harm. And we'll go over the 6 pillars again, but that should be just like at the front of your mind. How can I reduce causing harm to this child, to this classroom? And our administrators should be thinking the same to us. How can we reduce causing harm to the staff here because of all the things that they have on their plate?
I love that. And so let's dive into those 6 pillars.
So this is based on SAMHSA's 2014 paper, Safety, Choice, Collaboration and Mutuality, Trust and Transparency, Empowerment, Cultural, Historical, and Gender Issues. So those are the 6 pillars. And what I like to mention with everyone is these are not, again, a step-by-step, first you do safety, then you do choice. They all kind of waterfall into one another. You can't have safety without choice. You can't have trust without safety. Like they all mesh into each other. But if you go one by one and start asking yourself a question, where can I provide safety to this child specifically? Where can I provide choice to this child specifically? That's what you need to reflect on. So for safety, we can try our best to ensure physical and emotional safety. I also think it's really difficult in education. I hear it all the time that a lot of people assume themselves as their student's safe person. And I never say that I'm a safe person unless someone has told me specifically, unless a child has said, you are my safe person. Because if I just think I'm everyone's safe person, I'm potentially going to be causing harm in that way. I need to constantly be reflecting on what does this child need to feel safe in this room? Does their vision of safety look like my version of safety? And it often isn't, especially as an adult, and a child mind is very different. One thing about me, another fact, is I'm very scared of germs. Since COVID, before COVID, I've been a germaphobe. I am. It's been a struggle, especially over the last couple of years, when people decide what is safe for me. Because my threshold of safety for someone's sickness is a lot less than someone else's. So they'll take it upon themselves to say, well, I think it's just a cold. It's not a big deal. My tolerance for safety in that specific area is a lot less. So if you give me choice of, hey, Rachel, I know we were supposed to hang out today. I'm not feeling well. Do you want to recancel or do you want to cancel or do you want to get together? That is giving me the choice, giving me all the information. And I could say, you know what? I am going to take the chance today. Thank you for telling me. Or let's reschedule when I feel better about it or when you feel better. Both of us feel better about the situation, right? So where can you provide choice to your students? One thing to know about trauma survivors is they typically need an added sense of control in whatever environment they're in. So adding choice, whether it's you're giving them three activities they need to do and they get to pick which one, that is an added part of control that's necessary for them to feel safe in an environment. See, we're talking about choice right now, but safety, it always comes back to safety. Yeah. Any questions so far?
I often think about the choices, assuming the sale, right? Like we need to get something done, but let's say you can do it this way or that way, or you can finish now or in 5 minutes or, you know, kind of however, I don't know how that aligns with trauma-informed
care. Yes, absolutely.
I just am always just from that, you know, educator, parent, I'm always like, all right, time for this, but you can do it then or now, or, you know, whatever that
may be. That's super important because I don't think all parents or all teachers do have that mindset. It's you're doing it this way and no other options are available. I think whether you're a parent, whether you're an educator, to give them multiple choices, I do it all the time in speech, right? So I have students who come to me that don't want to go back to their math class, and I don't blame them because I hate math as well. But I'll say, you can either get pushed on my rolly chair. And again, I work with high schoolers. I can say, you can do that or you can sprint there. What would you like to do? You know, or for choice, I ask them, how would you like to get back to class? You know,
right.
So adding these relatively silly things or something that many people would feel is unnecessary, it's giving them choice at the end of the day. It's allowing them buy-in to something that we are saying, you have to go do that. How would you like to get there?
You can see this transforming or transcending all different needs of students, ages of students, all of that, and how helpful it would be to have that within an IEP as well. And really educating, kind of, it really does almost make our job easier when you add that in there.
It is. And a lot of people look to me and they say, wow, like your classroom management, these kids listen to you so well. And I don't think it's necessarily that they listen so well, but I'm giving them more options. I'm giving them more choices. And that also ties into our relationship building. Relationship building is the first priority for me. I always think it's funny when, you know, the first day of school, especially in high schools, because of the system that we have limited time and there's standardized testing and everything. Some teachers say, nice to meet you. All right, we're talking about math immediately, like 5 minutes in. You're not really leaving any time for that relationship building. And that is the most important aspect for me. And that is also done through the six pillars of trauma-informed care. I am constantly trying to evaluate and I ask my students, what would make you feel more safe in this room? What choices? I usually pick some choices for them, but if they are struggling, if they're having a panic attack or something, I would say, would you like some essential oils to sniff? Would you like a weighted blanket? Would you like whatever? Here's a box of things. You choose. What would you like? So I'm not taking on that like counseling aspect. I'm saying here's a box, a literal box of coping strategies. You choose what works for you.
Can we circle back to the safety part as well? Because I think this is critical, right? For just setting this whole stage. How do you help teachers and professionals within a school kind of set up that dynamic of safety within the classroom when you had just, you know, relationship building is huge? How do you go about introducing that concept or teaching that concept or bringing that into kind of like, this is a non-negotiable, this is where we are?
I think the safety component goes back to that survival brain and learning brain part, that if we put it in terms of if they are not in the learning brain and you're teaching them whatever, and they are in survival brain, what you're teaching is not going to connect to them and you're wasting your time. So if you prioritize the safety component, and safety is going to look different for different students, right? But if we focus on this child doesn't feel safe here, I could maybe give some additional choices. So especially in my situation, right? We had to come back to school. We were put back into the scene of the crime, and we had students and staff who we were hyper alert for probably 2 years straight. We were always in survival mode. However, when I noticed that one of my students is like shaking their legs and, you know, they're regulating their body without knowing it, but how can I help them? So I noticed one student would be constantly like turning themselves to look at the door. I asked them, do you want to turn that seat to the door? That way you're still looking at me, but you're not turning your neck. Can I come sit in front of you that way? That way, if you need to look at the door, instead of saying, look over here, why aren't you paying attention to me? Again, this is the mindset shift of not everything is a choice for them. When survival brain takes over, their brain is just saying, safety, safety, safety. I need to be safe. And you coming in saying everything's fine. Well, that goes into trust and transparency. Their trust was broken. Their safety was broken. All of these aspects were broken. So we are working on building that back. And if we're focusing on safety and choice and trust, we are trying to build back their trust in us, in all of it. And this is a specific example for students who have gone through specific trauma. But you might notice these same things in students that you don't know what their trauma is, or they don't even necessarily know what it is. It may not be trauma. It could just be that they're distracted with something. Where can you add choices? Where can you add safety? It doesn't just have to be trauma, and then I can support them better.
What does trust look like in a classroom, and how can teachers build that way, still kind of maintaining their routine and expectations and structures?
It's a great question. This one I was just talking about yesterday. I just got back from my national conference this week. I was in Seattle, so I'm all over the place with my time and everything. One of the examples that I give from a speech perspective is, you know, that we do articulation drills. Sometimes we'll say 100, we need 100 R's super, super fast. We might not tell them as speech pathologists, we need 100. We just say, go, 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 go. Well, let's say 30 in, the student's like, oh my gosh, I've had enough of this. Like, how many more do we have to go? And the SLP will say, just two more, or we'll be done in 2 minutes. But then it actually takes 15 more minutes. That's breaking down their trust, whether you think it's a big deal or not. That's breaking down their trust of, oh, she lied to me. She said we only had two more, but I just counted 50 more. You can do that in your classrooms. Being transparent with the activity that you are working on. Why are you doing that? A lot of neurodivergent people do need buy-in to what is being done. And if you just say, well, this is math and you're going to need that in the future, that sometimes isn't enough. If you use a real life example of here's how this works, whether it's geometry and you're building a kitchen, building something, here's how this works in real life, and trust. So task clarity, consistency, interpersonal boundaries, those are all things that foster trust and transparency. And just be mindful of the little things that you say that aren't as direct or clear because of situations like that. You might have a student that's just like really bothered by not knowing what comes next. Why are we doing this? Task clarity is always one of the bigger things to do.
So we've talked about safety, choice,
trust. And transparency.
Uh-huh. And task clarity. Yes.
That task clarity is what is within trust and transparency. And we have collaboration and mutuality. So that would be making decisions with the individual and sharing power, providing them a significant role in planning and their education, essentially. So for those of you familiar with the parenting types, we've got authoritarian, authoritative, permissive, and like neglectful. We should always try to aim to be the authoritative type, not authoritarian. So many teachers go in with the authoritarian model that I'm in power, you are the children, you are going to listen to me. What research shows is in the school system, that's not building relationships. It's not building trust, safety, choice, all of the pillars. Authoritative is what I always try to strive for, that you are still, it's not a power position. Again, you are sharing decision-making with the individual. So whether it's a four-year-old, you are working side by side, shoulder to shoulder. You are working together to work on whatever goals are set. You ask them, how would you like to work on this. Or if you find that your students really respond to Jeopardy, they like trivia games, and they say, why can't we do that more? Try to implement that more. If that's a learning strategy that they really like, I'm still that trivia kid. I love trivia. And that's how I learn best. I learn best by making mistakes. If I ever don't get a trivia question, I will remember that question for the rest of my life. So collaboration mutuality, it really just means working at the same level as who we are working with, and not from that power perspective, because that potentially could cause harm also.
How do we kind of set the stage for this? A trauma-informed care and the importance that it takes place and the precedence that needs to take place within our community, home, school. How do we navigate the challenges, right? So how would I address any pushback from staff or parents who may not understand the importance of trauma-informed care?
That's a tough one. I just did a presentation this weekend about the challenges to implementing trauma-informed care. And it really is a systems-based situation, right? So within the school system, some of the pushback that we see is lack of resources, lack of money. So a school, if they wanted to be trauma-informed, could have someone come and present on trauma-informed care and explain the importance of it. You might have some schools that say, that's not on our list of things to do. We don't have the money. We can use this money for something else that's more beneficial. The way that I always recommend, especially in the school system, when we don't always have those resources, is to model it yourself. Modeling it yourself is the best way to show someone why it's important. So I do get the comment often that, wow, your students really respond to you. You have a great relationship with your students. Your students learn a lot from you. They tell me that you're their safe person. Why is that? Because I continue to reflect on their six pillars, and I advocate for the systems above me to be trauma informed. I speak at my school board meetings. I write letters to the board members. I say, hey, is it something that you're interested in? I will present for free for my school district, and they're not super interested in it, you know? So these are choices that are made that are continuing the status quo. And the harm in that, what I make sure to put in my emails, is that we are potentially causing harm. One thing in education, a lot of educators keep saying that, you know, trauma, all that trauma at home. And we do have to recognize that school is another place that trauma does happen. So we want to reduce our risk of causing that harm, whether it's something that we say. Harm could be done unintentionally. That's okay. Part of the trauma-informed mindset is the repair is just as important. So if I say something that the next day I'm like, I was really short with that kid. One thing that happens all the time is a student will go into a room, a teacher will be upset by something, and they'll notice it and they'll say, hey, Miss A, are you okay? And I or whoever it is says like, I'm fine, don't worry about it. We're teaching kids to not really understand context clues, which that is my whole job as a speech pathologist, is teaching context clues. But we're saying that you are not correct. You're not right in your assessment of my body language, my tone. And it wasn't really nice of me to respond in the way that I did. So the next day I can say, hey, Johnny, I was upset yesterday. And thank you so much for asking. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I responded to you in the way I did. You are totally correct. I don't need to say, oh, and my boyfriend broke up with me or anything. We don't need to go into the reasons why. There's still those professional boundaries that we were talking about in collaboration and trust. But we can say, thank you for checking in on me. I could apologize. And I realized just a few years ago that I was never apologized to as a child, ever. And I think many adults can say the same, that as a child, you're not really apologized to by an adult until you become an adult. And I think it's really important, especially for my high schoolers, that when I apologize to them about something, they're like, you're allowed to do that? I didn't know that adults do that. So the repair is just as important. When they tell you something or when you hear something, you can apologize. It's totally okay. That's repairing the relationship and building that relationship with safety, choice, collaboration, trust, empowerment.
And I like that you noted that it could be the next day, right? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it takes us just being human time to kind of process and reflect on something and be like, oh, wait, hold on a second. I needed a moment and this is why. And thanks for noticing. So I think that's important to know as well. Absolutely. You know, that we're not going to get it correct all the time, but just having that awareness and that honest intention to set that stage is incredibly important.
Absolutely. And that's a great lead-in to one of the things that I recommend to be a trauma-informed provider or educator is a self-reflection for your entire career, throughout the day, throughout certain sessions. Starting at the top, do you know your stressor? Do you know your stressors? I know for me, something that really stresses me out is noise, loud noises, repetitive noises. I'm very distracted by them. So one thing that always bothered me, my room was next to this big patch of grass. So seems like every day, all day, they were mowing the lawn right downstairs. And it did take like 7 hours. So I'd be in there and it was so loud. I know what I look like when that is happening. It happens at my apartment. It happens. I hate the sound of lawnmowers. It really bothers me. So I know for me, loud noises or noises are going to be something that potentially dysregulates me. I know what I look like when that happens. I do get tense. I do get short with people. I might go quiet. So if a student says to me, you're really quiet, Miss A, I'd be like, yeah, I really don't like that noise or something, you know, it's really distracting me. Or I might put on some headphones. I do have multiple earplugs wherever I go because I know that this is something that does bother me. It's also important to note that for you educators, your students are going to dysregulate you. They are going to annoy you, and that is okay. That is completely valid. Some of the rooms that you're in, you might have kids who scream a lot, especially in some of the self-contained rooms. I do recommend to many teachers to have earplugs, not to completely shut out any noise because the safety component, but to reduce your dysregulation so that you can tolerate it for longer, so that your risk of causing harm when you are dysregulated is less. That's the whole goal of it, is there are going to be stressful things in our environment, but we need coping strategies to handle those things. Are you able to identify when you're stressed in the moment? Can you say, ooh, something's really bothering me right now. I need to take a moment. I need to, you know, go wash my hands. I need to go to the bathroom, whatever it is. How do you regulate yourself? Do you have any coping strategies? Because one thing that I learned at the school, all the staff was dysregulated and 0% of them had any coping strategies. So it was just dysregulated people walking around trying to regulate dysregulated children. We can't do that. A dysregulated adult cannot regulate a dysregulated person, whether it's a child, an adult, we can't do that. Is my dysregulation negatively impacting a class, a client, a student? Is my emotional regulation negatively impacting a lesson? And then finally, am I causing harm? And none of us go into this profession, whether it's education, healthcare, we don't go into this profession to cause harm. We actively try to help, right? But the reality is, if just going through this list, you don't have any coping strategies, you don't know what things stress you out, you potentially are causing harm. And the answer to this question of, am I causing harm? I would rather you say, yes, I have. And where can I improve upon that? Rather than saying, I've never caused harm and I never will, because that's probably not accurate. There's nothing to improve upon in that area. So I would rather say, yes, I have. Let me make sure I don't do that in the future. Or here's how I can prevent causing harm in the future.
What is one thing that somebody could start automatically, like right now as they're listening, to put the step forward to be trauma-informed and starting to reduce incidents and improve outcomes?
So I spoke about removing violent language. I think that's something that you could do immediately. A lot of people say, you know, take a stab at it, roll with the punches, target audience, push comes to shove, take your best shot, execute a plan, blown away. Those are just certain examples. Be more direct. Just say things directly. And we know many of our students have a difficult time with context clues or figurative language, which figurative language, I have a whole other rant about, that it's generational. So if I see a five-year-old saying it's raining cats and dogs, I'm like, have you been hanging with grandpa a lot? Like, what? Something's a little off here. But altering our language is the best way to start to make changes and the easiest way. One thing is removing toxic positivity. And just based on what you've shared with your experience, I'm sure with your child and the hospital setting, a lot of things were said that you might feel was very dismissive of, everything will be okay. You know, that was said to me a lot after my trauma. And I'm like, no, it's not. Like it's not. And that's okay. Like things don't always have to be okay. And I think that comes from a cultural thing, that our culture is very uncomfortable with an emotion other than happiness. So as soon as someone starts saying sadness, anger, whatever it is, they go, well, let's get that person back to happy because I don't know how to deal with you. And I think there are people who do respond to those toxic positivity phrases, like other people have it worse. I think that's like a perspective type thing. Someone will always have it worse. Like, we're not going to be measuring traumas, which is another thing that I didn't talk about today, is that it's not our job as educators to decide what's trauma and what isn't. So, for example, the word divorce. If you have a child whose parents are going through divorce, you start automatically putting together your life experiences, whether it's a friend of yours, your parents, whoever it was, and you start assessing, well, that's not trauma. It's an individual's perspective of an experience. But what research shows, the best way to help people cope is not using toxic positivity. It's validating emotions. And I can't tell you how helpful that's been in a high school setting, that, you know, they tell me this terrible story of their boyfriend broke up with them, blah, blah, blah. They're going on for 40 minutes. And I say, that sounds really tough. I'm sorry you're going through that. And they're shocked, you know, because a lot of people say, and I heard it just a couple weeks ago, you won't even remember him in 20 years. You know, these are very dismissive phrases that all high schoolers want, and all children, they just want to be heard. So we can use active listening. So think of it like counselor, like therapist speak, just listen. You're not putting in your input of, well, I was broken up with when I was your, no, that's not what a therapist does. They're there to just listen. You are there to listen. Seeking out trainings on trauma, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism practices, recognizing our own bias is a big one, whether that's cultural bias, religion, anything that is about us. We're not always thinking about everyone else. What things make my identity might not be the same as who we are working with. Teaching children and adults social emotional language skills very early, because I can't tell you how we had to work backwards at our school. We were teaching everyone social emotional language skills as they are dysregulated, and that's not an easy way to do it. So teaching them early, if you've ever heard like a 2-year-old say they're frustrated, it's the funniest thing, but it's also so great that we're doing that, right? Adding inclusive language for you educators when you send home a letter, instead of saying dear parents, one thing that I've asked teachers to do is saying dear adults, because the likelihood that a child is living with a parent, maybe, but they better be living with an adult, right? If they're not, then that needs to be investigated. We do have to investigate that part as a mandatory reporter, but not everyone is living with a parent. You might say, oh, well, it's a grandparent, and that, but it's not a parent. And when a child looks at that, they'll read that letter and they go, don't need to give that to grandpa because he's not my dad. We're also including and we're collaborating with the other adults, whether it is a cousin's cousin cousin, why they are living with them, we don't know necessarily, but we are including them because they are the guardian for whatever reason. Acknowledging that a reason a client is with you or a student might be traumatic for those of you that are working in ESE, self-contained. I know in Florida, we have a lot of near drowning accidents. So a lot of students come in with AAC devices. They are paraplegic. They're in these self-contained rooms because of an accident that happened. And we need to acknowledge that. And then going back to violent language, I think that's an easy one. But again, these are all just language changes. Things, again, it's a mindset shift. So I'm not asking you all of a sudden to eliminate violent language out of your vocabulary, but I want you to start thinking of, oh, there's one. Oh, there's one. Like, you're going to start noticing it more. And that's the first step to becoming trauma-informed, is just adjusting your mindset. It's a mindset shift.
I can't believe all of the information. I can't believe that an hour is almost up, which is just incredible information. And I think we've just barely scratched the surface on this. But as we wind down, what is something that I did not know enough to ask that I should have asked?
I think you asked incredible questions. I thought they led in perfectly to the next area. I think the only thing that we didn't really go over is what is trauma, which I'm actually glad we didn't talk about, because like I mentioned, it's an individual's perspective. So a lot of people get trained on trauma-informed care, and then they're so worried about, well, that's not considered a trauma. An example that I can give you is after everything happened in our school, we had many teachers leave, which is to be expected. We had a new teacher come in who was an ROTC teacher at the high school level. So this is a military man who came in to teach high schoolers, I guess, little military in a way. But as someone who has worked in military spaces for veterans affairs and with veterans from a speech perspective, I understood his question. So we had a training coming back, And he raises his hand and he goes, how do I know what kids have PTSD? From a military perspective, I understand, because in the military, you can't get help without like a specific diagnosis. And I went up to him after, this is a new person I don't know. And I just said, you have to assume that everyone here has trauma. We don't know if anyone has officially been diagnosed, and the diagnosis of PTSD is a whole other rant, that it's a medical model. We still have to acknowledge that a trauma has happened here. So if you are going to adjust what you're saying to one kid that you know has PTSD, do it for all of them, because everyone has gone through this here. So it's important to not put specific traumas in a box or start saying that's not a trauma, this is a trauma. We just have to take it as someone is showing signs and symptoms of a stressful something. How can we support them as educators? That is our role.
Thank you for that clarity. And as you were speaking, I was also just thinking, as somebody that's listening to the podcast, if they're thinking, okay, I have control over my domain, my classroom, my, you know, bringing kids in for service, how would you encourage someone that's not at the administration level, let's do building level instead of district level, to kind of bring up this context and conversation so that hopefully they can start to make the shift as well as an administrator?
I think, unfortunately, the way that we have to go about it is data. When you tie it to learner outcomes, that if we are putting teachers in stressful situations, if their caseloads are so high, the learning outcomes of a student might not be met. And for districts that are very worried about their school grades, the standardized tests, this is something that you could tie in and say, we will see better learning outcomes by reducing class sizes, by doing this, by having trauma-informed training. I think that's a way to get their attention about it, why it's necessary for them. Because in the school system, unfortunately, the bottom line is money, whether they have money, whether that is a value of theirs. And that's the other part that I presented during my administrative presentation. Some people are not interested in change. Some organizations are not interested in change. You have to show them why it's important, and whether that's in your specific classroom that you have seen learning outcomes based on when you started trauma-informed mindset, you can show that to them and say, let's do this district-wide, let's do this school-wide, let's do this department-wide. Start small and then work your way up, but always modeling is the best way to go about it.
If you had one tip for parents for a billboard, what would it be and why? Final question.
Be patient with yourself. I think that's a big one. Something that I noticed when people get trained on trauma-informed care is they start worrying about every mistake they've made. They feel that a simple mistake has caused their child trauma. And that is not the connection that I want you to make here. As we talked about, you know, repair is super important, but a mistake does not equal trauma. By having a trauma-informed mindset, you can start understanding different perspectives. My brain is on a trauma-informed mode 100% of the time, which is, it took years to get to that point. And it can be exhausting, but it's also building my relationship so much better. The questions that I'm able to ask, the time that I'm able to just stop and listen. I think my billboard for you all would be just be patient with yourself, give yourself grace that you're trying your best and you care.
How can people find you?
My Instagram is at ptsd.slp. I also have a website. It's www.ptsdslp.com. I have all my podcasts there, which this one will be included as well. Lots of information, and I do trauma-informed presentations anywhere from 30 minutes to 6 hours. So if you'd like to be trained, your district would like to be trained, tell them to reach out to me.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you so much. This is really just eye-opening, and I hope folks can start to think through this and start moving in the right direction. So thank you for your time and your honesty.
Thank you for having me. I'd love to talk more.
You bet. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.